Hey, Renter Retires, it's Adam Schrader here with another episode, joined as usual by the founder and CEO of Renter Retirement, Zach Leemaster. We are pleased to be joined today by Buddy Rushing. He is the owner and CEO of White Feather, has a fantastic real estate investing journey story. Buddy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys having me. This is a really cool setup you guys have here.
Yeah, well, we appreciate it. So let's start just kind of, we always like to hear about how people got into real estate and their first deal, but I think before you even started investing in real estate, you had, you know, I don't know exactly how old you were, but you had a little bit more of a backstory than that. Can you run us through kind of the beginning of your career and then kind of how you got into your first real estate deal?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only career that I've ever had is as a Marine. And so, you know, I grew up in East Tennessee, the youngest of five children. And, you know, we didn't really think about any of that kind of stuff in the 80s in East Tennessee. It was really more about, hey, how do we pay rent? And, you know, how do we find enough food to keep the family fed? And so, you know, fortunately there were government programs like WIC and food stamps that helped us out a little bit, but really it was about just surviving. But then whenever I was in high school, I visited the guidance counselor. One of the things that my parents really did emphasize a lot is get good grades, right? Work really hard in school and get good grades. And that may be your ticket to relieve a little bit of the strain of poverty. And, you know, so I did get good grades. And so in the guidance counselor's office, he was like, hey, where do you want to go to college? And I was like, bro, I can't afford college. Like, there is no college in my future, right? I can't afford it. And I worked throughout high school, so I didn't play any sports. So I couldn't get a sports scholarship. And he was like, well, have you ever thought about serving your country in the military? And, you know, my dad was a Marine in Vietnam. And so I'd always kind of, you know, been interested in the Marine Corps specifically. And I said, yeah, well, I mean, I've always wanted to be a Marine if possible. And he said, well, you know, there's a place called the U.S. Naval Academy. Have you heard of the Army-Navy game? And I'm like, yeah, of course. He was like, well, the Navy side of that is the U.S. Naval Academy. And if you get accepted, they pay for everything. I was like, what? Right, what? You know, they didn't tell me later that they get their money out of you. So,
plus,
you know, I've heard it described, Naval Academy education, as a $300,000 education shoved down your throat a nickel at a time. And, but to me, it was like, whoa, yeah, let's do it. So I'll fast forward the rest. It's a long story about how I got accepted. I barely made it. But that was the start of it. So I graduated the academy and I did get commissioned as a Marine. And you know, my start in real estate really began in, Afghanistan. I was on my first deployment and I was on a long range, patrol, basically an armored vehicle patrol. And if you've ever been on one of those or heard about it, it's not like the movies where they blast through the town and there's music playing and they're shooting up and it's super slow, right? Cause there's IEDs and roadside bombs everywhere. And so you have all of the, you know, the engineers and the counter ID guys up front, and they're going super slow, right? And so you have a ton of downtime. And so you're really bored. So we were on one of these long pauses and security was set up and everything. And I happened to glance down in between the radio mount and my seat, and there was a spine, a little purple book, right? And I pulled it up and I looked at it. And you know, of course, anybody in real estate knows already without me saying it that that's Rich Dad Poor Dad. And so I read it in one single sitting, just and it blew my mind. And I remember thinking to myself, no one has ever told me that it's possible that someone who is just normal can build generational wealth. Like, I mean, generational wealth, like my kids and their kids and their kids. And, you know, as long as we pass on these lessons we're learned, our legacy can change from poverty to one of abundance to one of opportunity. And I remember just the tingles all over my body. I had no clue what to do. I just believed it was possible because of that book. And then that led me to, let's call it, rashly jump off a cliff into my first investment, which was the worst investment to this day that I've ever done. And the lesson that I learned from that is, you know, it takes more than just excitement and belief to execute something. You gotta have systems, you gotta learn, you have to educate yourself, you gotta build your team, all the boring stuff, right? It can't just be about dreams. And so that's what got me into real estate was, yeah, a a book that inspired me, and then my first investment was just a gut-wrenching, horrible investment.
So gut-wrenching, horrible investment for number one. Why was there a number two? What led you to a number two if number one was so awful?
Goodness gracious, that is a phenomenal question that I will try to answer, but probably won't. So the first investment was I bought a two-bedroom, two-bath house with the only money that I had for investment. And, you know, and it was June of 2007. And my goal was to buy an old beat-up property and renovate it and then flip it. And it was June of 2007. So I had no idea that that was bad, right? Because by June, people had all, you can track it. Like, June wasn't a shock. Like, January was a shock. People in January were like, yay, this is going to go on forever. By June, people were like, eh, this is probably pretty bad. And I had no clue. And so I poured all of the money that I had into it, renovated it over 2 years. It appraised at the end of 2 years after renovation for half of what I originally bought it for. So all that money gone. The only money that we had left was my fiance and I had saved up $16,000 to pay for our wedding. And so that was the only money we had left in the world. And I remember thinking, well, this sucks, one. And two, it's interesting because it was in 29 Palms, California, which is a military town. And so the entire town had depreciated by 50, 60%. But troop strength was increasing. This was 2009. There were wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they were plussing up the Marine Corps, which means they were pouring more money into it, which means BAH, which is the allowance you get for housing, was going up. So the housing prices were half off, but the rent, which is correlated to BAH, was rising. What does that mean? What would your thought be?
Got a hold.
There's demand, right? There's housing demand. There you go.
Well, there's rental demand, right? Nobody wanted to buy. Everybody wanted to rent, and the rent was going up. And so my fiance and I agreed together, and I don't know why. You'd have to ask her. But, like, we agreed that we would get married at the San Bernardino County Courthouse and use that $16,000 to buy a brand new three-bedroom, two-bath, 1,400-square-foot house that literally had been built 6 months prior, foreclosed on twice in 6 months. Crazy. And we picked it up for $68,000 and rented it out for $975 the next day.
Wow.
That's a lot to unpack there, buddy.
Yeah.
Then thank you for sharing your backstory. I always love hearing, you know, that first, like, excitement into real estate. I think all of us remember that very well, and we have a lot of our audience that is at that point now. Right, where maybe they have invested previously, maybe they've had a bad experience previously, maybe this is their first investment, and certainly we try to help people make that first investment successful to help them avoid some of the pains, you know, which are never completely unavoidable. This is real estate, for one, but I think having a first deal that sets you up for success probably expedites your success long term. It takes grit and tenacity to have a challenging deal and then still see the light, right? And still be committed. I want to review just a little bit more of some things I heard from you. There's a saying I've heard other Marines talk about, which is ready, fire, aim. And it sounds like you're very much on the same page with that, right? Like, you're ready to go, man.
Ideally, you should ready your weapon, then aim, and then fire. But what he's saying is, a lot of times you're like, oh, boom, right? And you're like, oh, wow, that was... I acted too quick there, but yeah, that's exactly what happened. I read fire aim.
And his was actually fire ready aim from the sound of it.
Yeah, but that's okay. Look, like I'm the same way. It's like I'll take risks and jump into things with the understanding that I will figure it out. And not every real estate deal and certainly if you're doing it on your own, like some of those first deals can be very painful, but they're lessons. Yeah. Sounds like similar to the Naval Academy. Like those are hard knock lessons that you learn, and then you can apply later to be a better investor. And certainly we've known you for a long time. You're not new to our community. We've worked together on for many years, and we've seen how many people you helped, especially military members, improve their investing career path, either get started or collaborate with others. We'll certainly talk about your community. I want to talk about the first deal. So a lot of people can relate to this. Motivation from reading Rich Dad Poor Dad, kind of having this epiphany of, oh, this is how I should think about money. Although the book really is not a lot of action steps. It's really, I think, about mindset, which is really the first place to start. a lot of people are like, oh, like, tell me what to do. Give me the action steps. But the reality is you have to start with mindset. First, you need to change your mindset, and then you need to take action on that. I'm curious to know about, all right, so you figured out that you can be, you know, in control of your own destiny and kind of take control of your own finances with this concept of real estate investing and just thinking about business and investments in general the right way. From reading Rich Dad Poor Dad, and you decided to jump into rental real estate. Why flipping though? You decided that you wanted to buy an undervalued property, flip it. That flip took 2 years. That's a lot of time value of money. We hear this all the time from people that they want to get into flipping because they see that they can create a value add, right? They can create equity. And it very seldom works out for many people the first time because there's so many variables with flipping. That's a full-time job. It is high risk investing, make no mistake. So why flipping for you?
It was a mistake. It was a mistake. It was because the depth of my knowledge was, what is it called? What's one of those really poppy, flip shows on flip or flop. You remember flip or flop? Okay, or whatever.
Any of the HGTV, handful of flipping. All the glamour.
The glamour, none of the reality, and, none of the real talk about what margins actually are and time frames and all that stuff, right? So those are really just, they're entertainment, right? And I didn't realize that. I thought that they were education. And, and so I looked at that, and that's all when I thought to myself, oh, I want to make a bunch of money in real estate, it just naturally, because I'd seen a lot of those shows, I was like, okay, well, I'll just flip like those guys did. It was an absolute mistake because, one, I'm trying to flip starting in June 2017, right? Or, I'm sorry, 2007. And two, I didn't know anything. I decided to do all the work myself, me and Kimberly. We bought all the materials at Home Depot. We bought the books at Home Depot for how to build cabinets, how to scrape popcorn ceiling, literally it was just YouTube and books from Home Depot. And so we did it all ourselves. And that's why it took 2 years. And the me not understanding what a market was is why we lost all of that equity or all that value. But what I will tell you to your point before, taking the lessons from something as opposed to viewing it as a failure, right? I don't view Sun Valley as a failure. I still own Sun Valley, by the way. It's worth now twice what I bought it for, and it's rented for three times what I pay in mortgage, right? It's rented for $1,650, and I pay $600 a month in mortgage, so maybe 2.5 times. So it's a great cash flowing property now with about $180,000 of equity because I still own it, right? So what I learned in that is, one, there's nothing wrong with flipping, by the way. I've flipped properties since then, and that's fine. Flipping's okay, but it's an active, high-risk endeavor. And, if that's the way you want to go, you just have to understand the variables and the risk profile. But what I realized when we bought that house and rented it out for $975, and all of a sudden we were making, $300-$400 a month of cash flow every month, and it was appreciating, and it was paying itself down, and it was a tax haven, I looked at that and I was like, man, I even managed it myself, which we now no longer do. But even managing it myself, it was a few hours a month of work, right? And I looked at that and I said, okay, if what Robert Kiyosaki talks about as well is passive income financial freedom, right? Now, he talks about building businesses and stuff as well, but his kind of primary thing is passive income financial freedom. And so, we developed this sort of idea that if we really want to make generational wealth, then we have to build something that builds itself and that ultimately will feed us. And that's going to take a while. So we had our sights set on a 10-15 year horizon for that.
Now, we were talking about mindset. You mentioned coming from a family of five, worrying about, food and being on WIC and all of that. What was your family's reaction and how did you get over that whenever you said, hey, mom and dad, I'm going to buy a house and I'm going to live in it while I'm rehabbing it? Because, that is something that was probably completely foreign to them. I'm guessing they hadn't read the purple Bible yet. So how did you get over that hump? Because, a lot of families out there that don't understand real estate, they find out someone's going into it and their immediate response is, what the heck are you doing?
So I'll do you one better. It's been 15 years since then. And we have, you guys know the stats of what we've been able to create, right? And my mom and dad still don't really understand. Right. So, I mean, they are lovely people. And the thing that they do is they love me. Right. And they wish the best for me, but they just don't understand it. And to them, it's like, oh, this is this unknown world and it's risky. Right. You could just be careful. My mom, she's a, she is from Mexico, or she's from America, but like she's Mexican. And so she calls me Mijo, which means my son. And I remember how many times as we went along, I would tell her little snippets of, you know, success stories that we had, because I wanted her to be proud and excited. She's like, yep, that's great. Just be careful, Mijo. Right. And that's what she would say over and over, because she cares about me. Right. And we know that when you do it right, you can mitigate risk to the point where the reward is 10x, 15, 20x what the risk is, if you do it right. And you will make mistakes. You will run into problems. Like, you know, like there's, like, well, that moves this, right? Like I'm holding 20 lots in Southwest Florida right now, and the interest rates go through the roof, and then you have a hurricane come through, and then there's lags in the build process. So literally right now, it's nowhere near the kind of deal that I thought it was going to be at the beginning because of a lot of factors. But there's a lot that you can learn, and we're doing so much more that has worked. Last year, 2023, we did the two biggest deals in White Feather history, both of them last year. Both of them came available, in all honesty, because the interest rates went so high and these new developers weren't able to sell them. And so that more than offsets the extra tax and stuff that I have to pay for just holding onto these things for longer. So it's not about everything working. It's not about not making mistakes or everything. It's about doing way more that works than not. And that's how you mitigate the risk. And that's in my opinion.
Yeah, that's great. But I appreciate you sharing that perspective and just like the positivity, right? Because we all feel beaten down sometimes when you have a deal that doesn't go as according to plan, as seldom do. There's always challenges, but you got to look at those as opportunities. And also, I just heard you say that while so many people are sitting on the sidelines and letting interest rates dictate their investing, you jumped in and made some huge moves, which there is opportunity. To your point on risk, I say this all the time, but I mean, risk is always there. Make no mistake that risk is something that is always there. If you do nothing, if you're complacent, if you work your W-2 job,
that might be the riskiest move of all. That might actually be the riskiest move of all, is to work really hard at a job that doesn't fulfill you and doesn't create wealth for you and doesn't create financial freedom, and then get to the end of your life and realize all of that stuff that you could have experienced, you never got to. You tell me that's not more risky than what we're doing.
100%. I mean, so my advice and recommendation is to learn to embrace risk and evaluate risk, right? And like actually, instead of ignoring it, because that doesn't make it go away, learn how to use risk to your advantage and embrace it. Everything has risks. And I'm glad that you said that. Buddy, you've shared a little bit on what you're doing now, not in great detail, but like since that first flip, because you're doing a lot of different things, you have different partners, you have your hands in a lot of different stuff, you build an excellent community. Talk to us, like, let's fast forward a little bit, you know, to where you started to see success. And, you know, what are some of the lessons take away for our audience? Most of our audience is either newer investors or intermediate, right? They're like 10 doors and under. Some of them have much more, but I would say they're aspiring to get to that next level. And that could be different for every person. Maybe it's just earning a good return and diversifying. Maybe it's replacing your income, actually retiring, being full-time real estate, whatever the case is. What are some takeaway lessons that you've learned, and how has your philosophy changed over time in investing to like allow you to focus on what you're doing now?
Yeah. So the biggest thing, I tell people this all the time, and this is going to sound counterintuitive unless we actually go into examples, but you don't need a lot of money to build financial freedom. You just need knowledge. You need a network, and you need to take action. Those three things, that's the framework by which this larger community that we've created called Veterans for Financial Freedom. That's the framework. You just need knowledge. You need, and I mean real knowledge, right? You need to know the strategy, you need to build strategy, you need to build mindset, you need to be able to build that, you know, have the tactical knowledge, find your niche and focus on that, you know, and have systems in place. But you need to have knowledge. You can't just do that, right? You need to have a network. The biggest deals I've ever done were also the easiest deals I've ever done. When in terms of time commitment, in terms of, you know, stress, in terms of my actual sort of risk exposure and everything like that, the three biggest deals, Ocean's 11, Spiros 12, and Vistana Villas, all three of those things, which happened within the last 2 years, they all came from people in the network, and I didn't even know those places existed. They brought them to me, and I helped take them to the finish line and bring the investors and the capital and some of the other stuff, right? But basically, I dipped in those three examples. All I did was I dipped into the different parts of the network and brought the pieces together on the chessboard, and then we executed, and they were the three most lucrative deals in White Feather history, and they were also the three easiest from the perspective of, you know, stress and risk and work. Now, I say that to say the network. If the network didn't exist, if all of those natural resources inside the network didn't exist, this wouldn't have happened, right? Like it's easy to get your hands on $5 million if you have a network that is built on trust where people collectively have that. If you don't, then it's impossible to get your hands on $5 million. You don't even know where to start. But building a network, so the answer to your question is, from the way my philosophy has changed, and this is, I would have changed this the way I did it, because I did it alone for 10 years. We'd go to RIAs and stuff, but we effectively would save up money, put a down payment on, buy a property. Then we would, you know, buy a property and try to do a bird deal, but it was all our own cash. We had one partner we did on one deal, but other than that, it was just us, and I would have changed that. That caused me to have a 10, 11, probably a 12-year journey that should have been and could have been 3 or 4, right? And now that's what I do. The Real Estate Accelerator, it's named the Accelerator because I'm taking my 12-year and helping people compress it into 3 or 4 years. It accelerates their path. That's why it's called the Accelerator. If I had built knowledge and network and you know, I had the action. That was the good news. I had the action, but I didn't build the network. And you could say that I also was slow in building all the knowledge that I needed. And so that's how my philosophy has changed.
I couldn't agree with you more. And we all come to a point where it's like, hey, if you're doing it by yourself, both financially and just on your own, that's probably the slowest path to wealth, right? For you sure. Probably make all the mistakes that everyone else did.
You take all the risk yourself too. So you're taking all the risk. You have no backup as far as like, and here you guys, I'm sure, have seen this before. You have an insurmountable problem, something you just can't figure out. And you talk to people, and one person literally has an answer that solves everything. Like, if you've been in business long enough, you'll experience this, right? Where it's like, man, I really don't know how to crack this nut. And then you talk to maybe your attorney, who's also an investor, and he says, hey, I don't know if you knew about this strategy. I've used it before. And it completely solves this problem.
What recommendation, and I mean, that is so true as far as like that, that's the power of a network, right? Is connecting with the right people. And you can't really associate a price tag with that, right? It's just trying to put yourself out there and connect with the right people. Your network is your net worth. We all have heard that many times. And that's your story. Certainly, validates that. But let me ask you, for someone who is at that stage right now where they are limiting their own capital, right? And they've made some investments and it's like, okay, well, I'm at this pivotal moment where I could just continue to save up more money for down payments or potentially partner with people and look through that. What recommendation would you have? Because I feel like a lot of our investors are at that point. You know, they're looking for scalability is the name of the game here, depending on how large you want your portfolio to be. But what advice do you have to someone that is at that point where they're like, hey, I need to start partnering with someone on the first deal or raising capital or like expanding out beyond just doing it on my own? What do you tell that person?
You hit those three things. I wouldn't rush to partner as the first option, just because if you've never partnered before, you don't know what you don't know. And it can be partnering with someone can be like marrying them. And there's nothing more corrosive in this universe than divorce, according to my friends who've been divorced. There's nothing more corrosive and toxic than a nasty divorce. Same thing with a business relationship that goes bad. There's, you know, it ruins friendships, it ruins bank accounts, right? It leads to litigation where only the attorneys win and so on. So not trying to freak people out and tell I'm partnered right now with like, there's four of my properties I'm partnered with people on, right? But I would not recommend your first action being finding a partner. Raising capital is one thing. That's not partnering. That's raising capital. And I think that you absolutely, raising capital has to be a fundamental quiver or arrow in the quiver of anybody that's wanting to be an investor. It's a superpower.
It certainly is. Can you define both of those? Because I think a lot of people make the mistake of looking at those as being like congruent things or not really understanding how to form partnerships. I agree with what you said. I mean, partnerships, a lot of people, what we see is they jump into partnerships because they feel like they need to. There's someone, they're excited, they meet someone, mm-hmm. you know, but raising capital from someone is not a partnership.
Nope.
Can you define that for us a little bit more, buddy?
Yeah, absolutely. It comes down to expectation and control. So when you're in a partnership, the expectation is that you are in some form or fashion, either co-equal or somewhere in and around there. You both have say on what happens. You both have roles and responsibilities, and you both also are threat vectors. So if Zach, if you and I partner and we form an LLC and we go do a bunch of really great stuff, and then, you know, you get like, I don't know, or I get, either one, get like wrongly accused of something and dragged into court. And for whatever reason, we lose and they, you know, attach our assets. Well, guess what? Well, now I'm dragged into this with you, or you're dragged into this with me. What if you go through a nasty divorce, or I do, and all of a sudden it's just this contentious whatever, the other partner gets dragged into it. So it's when you form a partnership, it's about expectation and control, right? And if you don't, what often happens is people don't clearly define the roles, and so or define the expectations, and then, you know, resentment happens, and then when a deal goes bad, it's just a catalyst. With raising capital, all you're doing is you're saying, I'm going to give you the opportunity to invest in this instrument, and you will get this expected return if the deal performs well. Right? That's it. They have no control whatsoever. They also have very little risk other than just, you know, their returns being diminished, or maybe in a catastrophic, it's a loss of capital. But as the person who's borrowing the money, you tend to and should be taking more risk than them, right? And you should be putting capital in yourself if possible and so on. But it really comes when raising capital, I look at it like, okay, you're going to get an opportunity to invest in this. Your bonus, your return that you get is money. You don't have any control at all. Like, I will tell you everything that's happening, and I'm more than happy to take advice from you and things like that. But at the end of the day, the investor, the passive investor, the person who loans you capital, shouldn't be telling you how to manage the business. That's the key difference between raising capital and taking on a partner.
Yeah. Over the years, as you've changed, you know, we talked a little bit about how you've changed your investment strategy when it comes to, you know, your own money, raising other people's money, that kind of thing. How has your evaluating of deals changed over the years as you've gotten to be a, you know, more and more experienced investor?
I evaluate deals now. My first my first deal or two, I did not. I will tell you this: if you are a person of integrity or aspire to be a person of integrity, raising money from banks is one thing, right? You borrow money from a bank and they have an agreement, and they don't care about you. You don't care about them. If the deal goes bad, they just take your asset or whatever. Raising money from friends and family, which is where it normally starts, that is a whole different ballgame. You got, especially if you got people self-directing their retirement accounts into your deals. That's their retirement money. That's the money that whenever they are in their old age and they can't get a job anymore or anything like that, that's what helps send them into their golden years with dignity. If you blow that, you're robbing them in their weakest, most vulnerable state. You got to think like that, which means that you, honestly, man, my due diligence goes way up. And oftentimes what I will do when I raise capital is I come to terms with myself that if this deal goes bad, then I will give them one of my properties of equal value. I am not the guy that just says, oh man, there's risk in real estate. Sorry about that. Right now, like, what I mean by that is when I personally raise money, not whenever I'm a part of a syndication I'm invested in or anything. I mean, when I say, hey, Zach, I've got this deal. I need $100,000. It's going to be great. We're going to go do this deal. It's going to be, and Zach says, Roger that. Here's $100,000. If this deal blows up, Zach's getting his money back. Even if I have to give him one of my properties that's worth $100,000. Does that make sense? That's the level that I take it to when I personally borrow money from people. And everybody does it differently, but that's how I can sleep at night.
I know that, and I know that to be true, but it just because in my experience knowing you, as we mentioned previously, not every real estate opportunity deal works out, and you have given up. You know, you've been there, right? You you personally contributed to situations which you did not have to,
right?
With people, and you know, we have as well in many situations. But understanding that, like, you know, again, people do need to understand there is risk associated with any investment. There's risk associated with doing nothing, and you need to be in control of your own due diligence as well. Whether you're giving money to someone, whether you're doing your own properties. I mean, let me ask you though. Because someone could look at this and say, man, oh, that is like too much pressure. Like, mm-hmm. that is way too daunting for me. I can't do that, right? Like, I couldn't sleep at night just in case something went south. Just like the one.
Sure. I get that.
That could be holding them back potentially. What would you tell that person?
Well, I would tell them that they don't have to raise capital. Think about this. If you're out there finding more deals than you have money for, then you're finding deals. And so if you build your network of people that want to be investors and you're finding more deals than you have, why not wholesale them and start a wholesale operation that will refill your financial coffers, right? So one of the things that I like doing is I like creating a situation where I have active income and I'm using that active income to buy passive income assets. So if you're like, man, no, I really don't want to partner because, you know, I'm not in that game. Roger. What about raising capital? Well, that's too, I'm just not there yet. It's too nerve-wracking. I don't think I'm there. Okay, fine. Then create an active income source using the things that you're already doing. You're out there hunting for deals. You're analyzing them. You're locking them up. And so if they're a good deal for you, they're definitely a good deal for somebody else, right? And if that person doesn't have to do the work, would they be willing to pay you $5,000, $10,000 for your deal? Maybe 20, right? The Ocean's 11 deal we did. We marked those up $50,000 a piece, and the investors were overjoyed to pay it because we gave them $100,000 of free equity. So they were buying these, you know, houses for $550,000 that were worth $650,000, and that $50,000 that they were paying for, like that over the $500,000, that was our net. So Justin and I sold 11 properties. At some of them were $50,000, some of them were $6,000, one of them was $100,000, $100,000 wholesale fee we made on one of the properties. Right. In that deal, Justin, and so this is what you can go on my YouTube channel and you can see an interview I did with him. His name's Justin Lodby, if you guys are interested. So we go through the deal. It was a $5.5 million deal, right? He did not have he had like $10,000 in the bank when we did this deal, right? And so when we structured it together, you know, we ended up finding investors that were excited about it because we had the network we'd built, right? And then ended up wholesaling them, and his half of that was almost $300,000. And then he took that $300,000 and went and bought more properties. So if you, now that's a really big deal, but like just take a few zeros off and it still works. You find deals, you have investors that want those deals, but don't want to do the work, and then wholesale those deals. And that's a way to refill your investment capital.
And so it sounds like you actually had to have capital to close those. Is that right? On those wholesale?
Our investors did. I didn't use any of my own money. Neither did he. So what we did was we had them locked up, and we had a 90-day escrow. And then I sent out an email, and you've been on some of the investor calls I do, right? Where like I sent an email out, we get a bunch of investors on the call, and we just talked through the deal openly, like transparent about literally everything. And we had, you know, there was 11 properties, and we had like 16 investors raise their hand and be like, yep, I can afford the down payment. I can afford all the thing. And I'm really good with the wholesale fee, so let's do it. So then Greg Namro went and did what he does, right? He assigned investors to deals and then helped babysit it through escrow. And then they were the ones that brought the down payment, the closing cost, the wholesale fee and everything.
But okay, and thank you for that. I guess what I'm saying is you actually had to close those, because sometimes in wholesale deals, you can do an assignment of contract where there's no transactional capital involved.
Yeah,
sometimes you do.
No, we didn't close it. The investors bought them individually.
Oh, so you sold them to your network, basically.
Yeah.
Of investors. Yeah. Got it. Okay. Yep. And then that made sense for them, obviously, because there was still opportunity there. I see what you're saying. Thank you for that.
Yeah, they each got $100,000 of free equity and their short-term rentals, so their cash flow as well.
And, you know, we won't get into this, but possible tax accelerated depreciation if you're self-managing them. So,
100%, we've got like three of our guys that accelerated because, I mean, that's a legit like short-term rental, like accelerated depreciation because they were managing it. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. We have a lot of people. That's something we've been working with people on where they can buy a property. Usually it's new construction. They can furnish it, self-manage it for the year that they put it into service.
Yeah.
Take that accelerated depreciation next year. It's up to them. determine, I mean, if they want to turn it over to management, it doesn't matter at that point because they were actively managing for that first year. But for wholesaling, I mean, we won't go into that if anyone's here. Most people, I think, have heard of wholesaling. I just do want to say, like, that is an active business as well. It is a lower capital way to start. I bought rentals first, but that was one area I invested in. I just want to throw my two cents in here as well. If you're concerned about partnering with people, what my advice to you is, in any realm, just have proof of concept, right? If you have proof of concept that you can show someone, because it's different if you're raising capital for kind of this unknown where you don't have a deal under your belt yet. But if you have proof of concept, even if it's one deal or if it's multiple, where it's like, hey, this is the deal that I bought, and you walk them through the numbers, you know, that means a lot. And that should add confidence to you that, hey, this is a repeatable process. Now, there's always potential variables, but I tell this story all the time, but my brother-in-law, who does a lot of different things in real estate, he's also bought lots of properties with us where he's brought no money to the table because he finds investors and he's, you know, networking and he's finding the people, he's educating them. And he's done a lot of creative finance deals, but he also brings people to us where they'll buy property without putting any money into it. And he gets 50% of the ownership, the equity and the cash flow because he's overseeing it. And they're turnkey deals. It's very minimal time, but these are people that don't want anything to do with it. Right. And he shows them proof of concept. So there's a lot of different ways to skin the cat. So I know we're kind of running over on time, buddy. Let's talk about White Feather, you know, and what you're really doing for the veteran community. This is obviously a passion thing for you that's developed into a glowing business. Just tell us, like, what is White Feather? Just give us some information about that and maybe how people can find out about you.
I had this network of Marines that were all interested in investing. And so that's where it started. I started coaching them and like teaching them how to run the numbers and helping them do deals. And word just rapidly spread. And then, you know, people started saying, hey, we want you to do more than just coach us with deals, like teach me how to be an investor. And so we created the Real Estate Accelerator, which is a 6-month training program that basically takes people and turns them into business owners. And so that's been very successful. We've had around 300 people graduate from that and go on to build businesses and things. And so this last year, I'm very proud of this. We launched a free community called Veterans for Financial Freedom. And the purpose of that is to reach, there's 16.5 million veterans in the United States, and most of them are not financially free. So our moonshot is to eventually reach everyone. And so we launched the community, and, you know, within the last, 4 months, we've got about 1,200 people in it now. And it's a community that is meant to bring military veterans and their families together and teach them the things that they need to know to build financial freedom and then work together to rise together as a community. And so that's it. That's what we do. I mean, you can go to whitefeatherinvestments.com or veteransforfinancialfreedom.com. Or you can find me on any socials. It's just Buddy Rushing. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram. I've got a YouTube channel, all that stuff. You can just type in like Buddy Rushing Real Estate Investments. Cause if you just type in Buddy Rushing, you'll get Marines that are doing Buddy Rushes. And so
not coined from you back in your era.
No, not me. Right, a long time ago.
All right, buddy. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate you sharing your journey. And, you know, hopefully helping people, you know, figure out how they can continue improving their investing journey. So really appreciate that. We'll put all the links that Buddy just mentioned in the show notes, because there's a lot of value in all of those. So if you want to check out our turnkey investment opportunities, you can head over to renttoretirement.com. That's renttoretirement.com. Schedule a call, check out the inventory. And don't forget, if you have any questions that you want Zach and myself to answer in future episodes, email them to podcast@renttoretirement.com. That's podcast@renttoretirement.com. Really appreciate the time you spent educating yourselves today. We'll talk to you on the next episode.